content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. And this is The Week Magazine. For the next hour, I'll be reading you from the April 24th, 2026 issue of The Week. Our cover drawing this week. In the background, we have two flags, the flag of Hungary and the American flag. In the foreground, we've got Viktor Orban and J.D. Vance. Viktor Orban is looking pretty beat up. He's got a black eye, bloody nose, his shirt's disheveled. And J.D. Vance is standing next to him, got his arms around him in kind of a consoling pose and a tear running down his cheek. The headline is "Ousting an Autocrat: What Orban's Defeat Means for MAGA and the Populist Right." That will be our second main story. I think we'll read both of the main stories today, starting with Iran vows retaliation after U.S. blockades ports. What happened? President Trump this week declared that the U.S.-Israeli war with Iran was very close to over, even as he ordered a naval blockade of Iranian ports, and Tehran threatened to strike back by attacking shipping routes across the Middle East. The blockade is intended to force Tehran to accept terms after direct talks between U.S. and Iranian officials in Pakistan ended without a deal to halt the conflict or to reopen the Strait of Hormuz, a Persian Gulf waterway that carried a fifth of the world's oil before it was closed by Iran during the war. Vessels attempting to access or leave Iran's ports will face interception, diversion, and capture, said U.S. Central Command. More than 15 U.S. warships and 100 aircraft are enforcing the blockade, which turned back 9 vessels, at least 5 of which were carrying oil, in its first 48 hours. Another 10,000 troops are expected to arrive in the region over the next 2 weeks. Iran warned that if the blockade continues, it will halt all marine traffic in the Persian Gulf, Sea of Oman, and Red Sea, and strike ports and other targets across the region. Trump said that if Iran escalated, we could take out every one of their power plants in an hour. We don't want to do that. Meanwhile, Pakistani mediators work to extend a 2-week ceasefire due to end April 22nd and to restart talks. Vice President J.D. Vance, who led the U.S. delegation in Islamabad, said the sticking point was Iran's refusal to end its nuclear program. Vance proposed a 20-year moratorium on uranium enrichment, multiple outlets reported. Iran countered with 5 years. "We've made very clear what our red lines are," said Vance. The U.S. announced that Israel and Lebanon had agreed to begin direct negotiations to end fighting between Israel and the Iran-backed militia Hezbollah, which threatened to derail the ceasefire. Trump, who attended an Ultimate Fighting Championship match in Miami during the negotiations, said he was confident the economic pressure generated by the blockade would force Tehran to open the Strait of Hormuz and agree to never have a nuclear weapon. Trump said other nations would join the U.S. flotilla, but none did, and some pointedly refused. "The blockade makes no sense," said Spanish Defense Minister Margarita Robles. "Since this war started, nothing makes sense." What the columnist said. Vance's failure to reach a deal was inevitable, said Fred Kaplan in Slate. "Such negotiations can take months, not the 21 hours he spent at the table. And we sent 3 envoys, Vance, the president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, and special envoy Steve Witkoff, with no deep grasp of nuclear issues or experience at real diplomacy. Iran has expressed willingness to restrict uranium enrichment to 1.5% purity. Weapons grade is 90%. That's an opening for deal-making, but instead Vance walked. "It's clear, Trump, who's deluded enough to think he's winning, didn't want a deal that required any U.S. compromise. Iran wasn't about to crack either, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. It took Trump's eagerness for a ceasefire as a sign of desperation and confirmation it has the upper hand. The resulting U.S. blockade makes sense as long as Trump is willing to accept the energy market pain that's coming. Iran's economy will buckle from the collapse of oil exports, the main revenue source of the regime. It now has an incentive to fully reopen the Strait of Hormuz, as does China, whose tankers have been given priority. The blockade is a throwdown the U.S. can't win, said Mark Champion in Bloomberg. Trump wants to squeeze Tehran without escalating the war. But that works only if you believe the mullahs will fold under the resulting economic pressure before Trump does. In reality, the regime has the whip hand because it is willing to inflict more economic pain on its populace than Trump, whose approval rating is falling as the war's shockwaves hit home. Iran's parliamentary speaker warned Americans this week they'd soon be nostalgic for $4 to $5 gas. Overwhelmingly skeptical of the war, Americans have no stomach for sacrifice, said Martha McCarty in the Daily Beast. In a new Ipsos poll, only 24% of voters said the war has been worth the cost, and 60% oppose it. In dozens of interviews on the war with voters in military towns, many expressed anger, frustration, even bewilderment, said Jack Healy in the New York Times. Some are baffled about what Trump, who vowed to keep the U.S. out of wars, wants to achieve in a conflict he did not prepare them for. Meanwhile, enforcing the blockade could put American service members at risk, said Bryn Tannehill in the Atlantic. Vessels trying to evade it might hug Iran's shoreline, exposing responding U.S. ships to missile and drone attacks. If a vessel refuses to stop, the Navy will have to decide whether to order search and seizure teams to board without cooperation, a risky venture, or to disable the vessel by firing on it. And what will happen if that ship is Chinese? 7 weeks into Trump's war, things are looking bad, said Ryan Evans in War on the Rocks, and it's hard to see how the path ahead gets much better. The strait is shut. Energy markets are in turmoil. A hardline regime remains in charge in Tehran, and its battered forces remain capable of waging warfare. This is what happens when you blunder into a war with no coherent political objective and then mistake tactical success for victory. Negotiations may continue, but Trump must realize he's not a victor imposing terms. Until he does, we aren't just walking the path to defeat. We are blindly sprinting down it. And our second main story. MAGA takes a hit as Hungary's Orbán voted out. What happened? Hungarian voters booted out their longtime prime minister, Viktor Orbán, in a general election this week, dealing a blow to the European far right and robbing the Trump administration of its biggest cheerleader in the EU. Though the Kremlin-friendly Orbán had held power for the past 16 years, partly by tilting the electoral system in his favor, his far-right Fidesz party lost to the center-right Tisza party of anti-corruption campaigner Peter Magyar. With turnout at a record 80%, Magyar took a two-thirds parliamentary majority, which will allow him to undo the changes Orbán made to Hungary's courts, elections, and press that had restricted the country's democratic freedoms. While Orbán had been expected to cry fraud if he lost, the trouncing was too complete. Instead, he conceded quickly as pro-Magyar crowds celebrated across the country. Magyar pledged to work more closely with the EU and NATO and restore checks and balances. Together we liberated Hungary and took back our country, he told cheering supporters. Those who commit the sin of dividing the nation must leave power. Ahead of the vote, the Trump administration had made a show of supporting Orbán, with Vice President J.D. Vance visiting Budapest last week to campaign with him. President Trump even called in to a rally to praise Orban's anti-immigrant policies. "I love Viktor," he said. "He didn't allow people to storm your country." Russia, too, had an interest in keeping Orban in power, as he had consistently advanced Kremlin aims by blocking EU aid to Ukraine and vetoing EU sanctions on Moscow. "This is not just a repudiation of Russian influence," said Ian Bremmer, head of the risk advisory firm Eurasia Group. "It's also a repudiation of Trump." What the columnist said. "Why was the White House so invested in seeing Orban prevail?" asked Nick Cottagio in the Dispatch. "Because MAGA elites look to his illiberal Christian democracy as a model, even holding an annual conservative confab in Budapest. Orban was the Ur-Trump who proved back in 2010 that voters would flock to an anti-immigrant and culturally reactionary strongman. And crucially, he showed that such a person could entrench power by packing courts with loyalists, handing the press over to friendly oligarchs, and rigging the election system for his own party. Yet eventually, Orban forgot a basic rule of politics," said Andrew Higgins in the New York Times. "A populist must actually be popular to win elections. But as Hungary's economy became deformed by corruption, voters grew angry. Hungary today has the slowest growth in the region, and unemployment is at a 10-year high. In the end, even Orban's near-total control of the media, which effectively barred Magyar from TV during the entire campaign, was no match for reality. That's why Fidesz's shellacking could be an omen for Trump's MAGA movement," said Max Boot in the Washington Post. "Like Orban, Trump presides over flagrant corruption while inflation is rising and economic growth slowing. He could face a similar smackdown in the November midterm elections. That would be more likely if Democrats were to follow Magyar's script," said William A. Galston in the Wall Street Journal. "The Hungarian challenger's disciplined and energetic campaign focused on bread and butter issues, cronyism and corruption, economic stagnation and inflation, and decaying public services. Wisely, he avoided discussing divisive social issues or attacking his opponent as an enemy of democracy." "Don't read too much into Orban's defeat," said Jamie Detmer in Politico. "Sure, it's tempting to see Hungary's results as a symbolic setback for populists everywhere, especially given the effort that Trump and Vance have put into juicing far-right European parties. Yet elections reflect local political and economic circumstances much more often than broad and lasting transnational trends. This vote in a nation of only 10 million isn't a devastating blow to the far right, not in Europe and not in the U.S. "Perhaps not," said Ann Applebaum in The Atlantic. "But it does show that illiberalism is not inevitable. There's been a belief within the MAGA movement, one that's also present in Russian President Vladimir Putin's rhetoric, that it and its international brethren are somehow destined not just to win, but to hold power forever, because they have the support of the real people. But that's no longer the case. Hungary showed that real people grow tired of their rulers. Old ideas became stale. Younger people question orthodoxy. If Orban can lose, so too can his Russian and American admirers." Controversy of the week, Trump versus Leo. Why the president took on the Pope. K countdown began as soon as the Chicago-born Robert Prevost was elected Pope last year, said Nick Cottagio in the Dispatch. President Trump was never going to let another American challenge his moral leadership. So it was only a matter of when, not if, he'd pick a fight with the new pontiff. That moment arrived last week after Pope Leo XIV denounced Trump's genocidal threat to end Iran's whole civilization as truly unacceptable. Trump shot back with a post accusing Leo of being weak on crime, terrible for foreign policy, and catering to the radical left. 46 minutes later, for good Pope-baiting measure, Trump posted an AI-generated image of himself as a robed Jesus, bathed in golden holy light, miraculously healing a bedbound man. Even for many MAGA diehards, this blasphemous image was too much, said Jeffrey Blahar in National Review. Trump later deleted it, claiming he thought it depicted him as a doctor. But he doubled down on his criticism of Leo, who was joined by Vice President J.D. Vance, a Catholic convert, who advised the Pope to be careful when talking about theology. For an unpopular administration embroiled in several other global messes, this seems like an odd moment to declare a MAGA fatwa on the leader of the planet's 1.4 billion Catholics, among them 20% of U.S. citizens. Did Trump pick this fight, or did Leo? Asked Paul Ellie in The New Yorker. Vatican Convention holds that the Pope should be neutral in international conflicts, but on Palm Sunday he said God rejects the prayers of those with hands full of blood, a clear shot at the crusaderish rhetoric of Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, an evangelical Protestant who recently called on Almighty God to grant U.S. forces overwhelming violence of action against those who deserve no mercy. And last week, Leo referenced Trump by name for the first time, calling on the president to find an off-ramp in Iran. This spat didn't start with Iran, said Kira Butler in Mother Jones. Leo also criticized Trump's immigration crackdown and his January raid on Venezuela, and channeled the mounting anger of many Catholics over Israel's brutal campaign in Gaza. With the U.S.-Israeli attack on Iran, that frustration turned to opposition, and the war is now tearing apart the Catholic evangelical coalition that elected Trump. He had hoped to forge a special bond with an American pontiff, said Mattia Farrarisi in the Free Press. After all, the president gave the Supreme Court a Catholic supermajority, and his administration has a striking number of Catholic top officials. But relations with the Vatican have instead deteriorated so severely that during an unusual January meeting at the Pentagon with the Holy See's U.S. ambassador, one U.S. official reportedly invoked the Avignon Papacy, a period in the 1300s when the French crown used its military might to dominate the papal authority. Leo's not looking for a fight with Trump, said David Gibson in the New York Times. He's looking past him. A fit 70-year-old with a lifetime appointment, Leo sees it as his mission to shape the post-Trump global order and help Catholics rediscover the virtues of peace, compassion, and common decency over jingoist bullying. Leo's quiet, confident witness is already resonating with American Catholics, said Gustavo Arellano in the Los Angeles Times, giving them the courage to reject Trump's cruelty and selfishness. Pope Leo declared this week that he has no fear of the Trump administration, and we shouldn't either. Here's our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for the art of the deal after Ugandan Defense Chief General Muhoozi Kainerugaba demanded that Turkey pay his nation a $1 billion security dividend and supply him with the most beautiful woman in that country for a wife. If Ankara fails to meet his demands within 30 days, the general warned, Uganda will cut diplomatic ties and shutter the Turkish embassy in Kampala. was a good week for rodents after Cambodia unveiled a 7-foot statue of Magawa, a 3-pound African pouched rat who sniffed out more than 100 landmines during a storied 5-year career. Magawa, who died peacefully in 2022, knew his job, said his trainer, Michael Rain. It was a good week for fresh starts after Eric Adams, the former mayor of New York City, home to the U.S. largest Albanian expatriate community, was granted Albanian citizenship. "He loves Albania," Adams' spokesman, Todd Shapiro, explained to the New York Times. "He does." But it was a bad week for accountability after the Wall Street Journal reported that President Trump has promised to pardon his entire administration before leaving office, including everyone who has come within 200 feet of the Oval Office. White House Press Secretary Caroline Levitt said Trump's statement was a joke, but added, "The president's pardon power is absolute." It was a bad week for wayward sons after attorneys for Hunter Biden, the formerly crack-addicted, influence-peddling son of President Joe Biden, told a judge that Hunter now lives abroad and cannot afford to pay his legal bills. Finally, it was a bad week for family outings after a new biography of Robert F. Kennedy Jr. revealed that the current health secretary, while driving down the highway with his wife and kids in 2001, pulled over his minivan so he could slice off the genitals of a road-killed raccoon. "My kids waited patiently in the car," Kennedy wrote in his diary. On the briefing page, we have Cuba goes dark. The U.S. oil blockade is pushing the island and its communist regime to the brink of collapse. What's the situation in Cuba? The country is running out of fuel, and fast. Oil shipments from Venezuela, Cuba's main fuel supplier for the past 3 decades, ended in January after the U.S. attacked the South American country and captured its president, Nicolas Maduro. President Trump then declared a full oil blockade, threatening severe tariffs on any country that sent Cuba fuel. The blockade has exacerbated a long-simmering economic and humanitarian crisis for Cuba's 11 million people. Blackouts of up to 20 hours are routine, and their consequences are severe. Running water has been cut off in many urban areas because the systems rely on electric pumps. Trash is piled up for lack of gas to run garbage trucks. And doctors say preventable deaths are rising as equipment fails. In late March, the U.S. Coast Guard allowed a single Russian oil tanker carrying about 730,000 barrels of oil to pass through the blockade, providing Cuba with, at best, a few weeks of fuel. "It's not going to have an impact. Cuba is finished," Trump said, "and whether or not they get a boat of oil, it's not going to matter." How did Cuba get here? The island has been under U.S. sanctions for nearly 7 decades. What began with an arms embargo during the Cuban Revolution in 1958 was broadened into a full trade and travel embargo after Fidel Castro established his communist government. While Castro's rule saw an expansion of access to education and health care, alongside those gains came political repression and the confiscation and nationalization of private land, businesses, and homes, prompting millions of Cubans to flee. The U.S. trade embargo, the longest in modern history, intensified Cuba's chronic economic woes, which deepened after the collapse in 1991 of its main foreign backer, the Soviet Union. The Cold War era embargo continued until the second term of President Barack Obama, who sought to ease what he called a rigid policy that is rooted in events that took place before most of us were born. What did Obama do? Believing a rapprochement could reduce repression on the island and provide economic opportunities for ordinary Cubans, he opened discussions in 2014 with Raul Castro, Fidel's brother and successor. The Obama administration restored diplomatic relations and struck Cuba from its list of state sponsors of terrorism. In March 2016, Obama became the first U.S. president to set foot in Cuba since Calvin Coolidge in 1928. Americans were allowed to travel to Cuba for educational purposes for the first time in decades, and direct commercial flights resumed and embassies opened. Cuba's tourism revenue jumped 15% in the first half of 2016, and a record 4 million foreigners visited that year. But few Cubans reaped benefits, as increased demand for food and poor planning caused shortages and price hikes. It's a disaster, said Licit Felipe, a government-employed air conditioner seller, in 2016. We never lived luxuriously, but the comfort we once had doesn't exist anymore. Why didn't the thaw last? On the campaign trail in 2016, Trump pledged to undo Obama's policies, promises that helped him win the votes of a majority of Cuban Americans in Florida. In office, he imposed a maximum pressure campaign against Cuba and put the country back on the list of state sponsors of terrorism. Though President Joe Biden reversed that move in his last week in office in January 2025, Trump quickly reimposed it after returning to the White House last year, with a newfound interest in Latin America, heavily influenced by Secretary of State Marco Rubio, a foreign policy hawk and the son of Cuban immigrants. Trump's first target was Venezuelan autocrat Maduro, a close ally of Cuba, and many Cuban Americans saw that intervention as a step toward realizing Rubio's desire to topple the island's communist government. If I lived in Havana and I was in the government, I'd be concerned, at least a little bit, Rubio warned hours after the January raid that captured Maduro. What does the White House want? The end of Cuba's communist government. The Trump administration has been negotiating with President Miguel Díaz-Canel's regime and seems inclined to avoid using military force, hoping the blockade will inspire Cubans to rise up against their government. Protests are spreading with furious residents banging pots and chanting, "We've had enough. Freedom, and put the lights back on." In the central city of Morón last month, protesters set the Communist Party's local headquarters on fire, the biggest show of dissent in years. But the blockade is also inflicting pain on ordinary Cubans. The U.S. is trying to punish the Cuban government, said one Havana resident, but it's the people who are suffering. How do Cubans feel about the blockade? They're desperate. In a country where the official average monthly wage is about $15, gas is now nearly $40 a gallon if you can find it. There were three major blackouts in March, and the United Nations has warned the blockade will result in a severe humanitarian crisis, with fuel shortages hitting every aspect of the island's food system, from irrigation and harvesting to refrigeration and distribution. Health experts predict diseases such as dengue and chikungunya will return. Cuba's once vaulted health system is collapsing. There's little fuel for ambulances. Doctors and nurses are unable to commute to work, and pharmacy shelves are bare. Many refrigerated medicines spoil when the power goes out. Doctors say premature births are increasing as an antibiotic shortage leads to rising infections. It's also getting harder to administer chemotherapy amid blackouts, and patients on ventilators now rely on backup batteries or hand pumps. I don't know how long we can keep going, said Zenia Alvarez, whose 21-year-old son's lungs can't pump air on their own. His life depends on electricity. and a few of the best columns, starting with Why Israel is Losing U.S. Support. Israel is winning wars, said Matt Lewis, but it is losing something just as important, the American public. A new Pew Research Center survey found that 60% of Americans view the Jewish state unfavorably, up from 53% in just a year. Hamas' October 7, 2023 massacre of 1,200 Israelis created sympathy for Israel that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu squandered with a hyper-aggressive response, including the killing of thousands of civilians in Gaza, Iran, and Lebanon. Netanyahu's bromance with President Trump has pushed mainstream Democrats away from Israel, and the two countries' joint war in Iran has left many non-interventionist Republicans feeling betrayed. It won't help that the New York Times last week revealed that Netanyahu secretly came to Washington to persuade Trump to go to war with Iran. Netanyahu painted an overly optimistic picture, telling Trump a bombing campaign would be quick and decisive, leaving Iran ripe for regime change and incapable of retaliating or closing the Strait of Hormuz. Trump's own advisors told him the Israeli scenario was farcical, but he bought it. Trump is responsible for his own decisions, but if this messy war drags on, public anger will grow, a flashing warning sign for Israel. You can be both Muslim and American. A minority's right to exist in America should not depend on its willingness to converge with the cultural mainstream, said Shadi Hamid. But Muslim Americans face increasingly shrill demands to assimilate that are essentially demands for self-erasure. 60 House Republicans now belong to the Sharia Free America Caucus. Republican Representative Andy Ogles of Tennessee spoke for many of them when he said, "Muslims don't belong in American society." Observant Muslims can't disavow Sharia, which governs their own prayer, fasting, and other religious practices. Ironically, these Muslims are religiously conservative in ways that align with the GOP base. 55% of Muslims say society ought to discourage homosexuality, and 63% think a family should have a stay-at-home parent. Two-thirds of Muslim Americans pray daily. Whether you think that's admirable or worrying probably says more about you than it does about them. Integrating into our society should not require becoming less yourself. America was founded as a pluralistic society on the radical proposition that people who disagree about God, religion, and the good life could share a country anyway. A real American is one who embraces that noble ideal and doesn't see our differences as problems to be solved. This column comes from El Salvador. How we became a police state. El Salvador today is the largest open-air prison in the world, said David Alfaro. In the 4 years since lawmakers approved President Nayib Bukele's state of emergency to fight gang violence, nearly 100,000 Salvadorans have been summarily arrested without charges and hurled into hellish, overcrowded prisons like CECOT. The world saw how bad the conditions there are when then-Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem posed in front of CECOT in 2025, showing off the U.S. deportees being kept there. But what the world doesn't realize is that 4 in 100 Salvadoran men are also being kept in such prisons, the highest incarceration rate in the world. Hundreds of the prisoners have died from torture or lack of medical attention, to be buried anonymously in government mass graves. Those who survived are abused, extorted, and even gang-raped by guards. What justifies such brutality? Bukele already had the ability to target gangs under existing laws. He's using the state of emergency for something more sinister. It's a mechanism of repression a way to suppress all criticism and protest movements. Now that Bukele has desensitized the population to state violence, he can rule like a dictator over people too frightened to rise up. And on to the last word, our feature article. The robotics revolution. Chinese firms are pioneering a new generation of AI-powered robots to labor in homes and factories, said Chang Chi in The Guardian. Will there still be a need for human workers? Chen Ling, the founder of Gucci Robotics, an automation company headquartered in Shanghai, is a tall, heavy-set man in his mid-40s with square-rimmed glasses. His everyday manner is calm and understated, but when he is in his element, up close with the technology he builds, or in business meetings discussing the imminent replacement of human workers by robots, he wears an exuberant smile that brings to mind an intern on his first day at his dream job. Gucci makes the machines that install wheels, dashboards, and windows for many of the top Chinese car brands, including BYD and NIO. He took the name from the Chinese word G-U-Z-H-I, steadfast intelligence, though the fact that it sounded like an Italian luxury brand was not entirely unwelcome. For nearly two decades, Chen, an engineer by training, has tried to solve what, to him, is an engineering problem. How to eliminate, or, in his view, liberate, as many workers in car factories as technologically possible. At present, his robots can mount wheels, dashboards, and windows into a car without any human intervention. But 80% of the final assembly, he estimates, has yet to be automated. As in much of the world, AI has become part of everyday life in China. But what most excites Chinese politicians and industrialists are the strides being made in robotics, which, when combined with advances in AI, could revolutionize the world of work. Many researchers believe that machines can learn to navigate the physical world the way ChatGPT learned to navigate language, not by following rules, but by absorbing enough data for something like human dexterity to emerge. The aim for many technologists is the development of humanoid robots capable of performing factory labor, work that employs hundreds of millions of people worldwide. The resources being pumped into achieving this goal are staggering. In 2025, China announced a $134 billion fund for strategic technologies, including quantum computing, clean energy, and robotics. Major cities have invested their own resources into robotics projects, too. There are now roughly 140 Chinese firms hoping to build humanoids. Some of the frontrunners have made their debut in February at the Lunar New Year Festival Gala, a state-choreographed spectacle loosely comparable to the Super Bowl in terms of bombast and national significance. The speed of progress has been startling. Last year, the robots were doing a synchronized cheerleading routine. This year, they did cartwheels and parkour. The intended message was clear. The robots are coming, and China will be the nation building them. Inside of one of Gucci's robotics warehouses, a team of employees from General Motors was testing Gucci's wheel installation machines ahead of a shipment to Canada. The hull of a white GM truck occupied a raised platform at the center of the room. The truck, surrounded by four large robotic arms and a jungle of wires, sat inside a yellow safety enclosure made of steel bars. I watched on the sidelines as a bearded GM engineer tinkered with a control panel outside the steel cage. The engineer, an American man I'll call Jack, worked in GM's manufacturing optimization division. To be grim, anything that eliminates people from the production line is basically my job, Jack told me. GM sets job reduction targets for his division each year, he said, which requires eliminating a set number of factory workers across all plants in North America. The purchase of the Gucci machines, he said, would eliminate 12 assembly operators on the line at a single factory. General Motors did not confirm the job reduction targets, but a spokesperson said it implements technology to help improve safety, efficiency, and quality, particularly for physically demanding or repetitive tasks. Jen and I walked to where we had a frontal view of the GM truck. After watching Jack work for a bit, Jen pointed me to the robotic arms on each side of the car body. You see those? This is the screw-driving robot. Even if manufacturing does come back to North America, they won't be putting workers on the line to fasten screws anymore. They'll use robots. 1 week after my visit to Gucci HQ, I met Chen in northwest Beijing at the head office of Galbot, one of China's most hyped humanoid robotic startups. Since its founding in 2023, Galbot has pursued a less showy strategy than many of its competitors, building robots that can perform mundane tasks such as picking up items and setting them down elsewhere safely and reliably. The founder, Wang He, told a Chinese reporter recently that their robots are already deployed in several Chinese car factories, though videos appear to show them in highly controlled settings. The kind of technology being developed at Galbot is what roboticists call a vision language action model, or a VLA, which aims to allow machines to operate in unfamiliar and fluid environments, just as humans do. For now, Galbot's robots cannot reliably do what, for humans, would be trivial tasks, say washing the dishes. But Wang has told Chinese reporters he aims to have 10,000 robots handling basic retail and factory work in 3 years. The purpose of Chen's visit was to see how Galbot's robots could be deployed inside an electric vehicle factory, one of the most complex manufacturing environments in the world. Such a feat requires training the robots on a glut of factory scenarios, but there is no ready-made database waiting to be drawn upon. A big reason that the ChatGPT moment for robots hasn't yet arrived is the scarcity of data, which researchers have two ways of collecting. One is through a manual process called teleoperations, where humans guide a robot to do a precise task, sometimes hundreds of thousands of times. Each task records a package of data, including visual information, hand positioning, torque depth, called an action sequence, that will later be used to train the VLA. The method is labor-intensive, which is why Galbot prefers the second. Building virtual environments, it's like Avatar, the engineer told us, referencing the blockbuster film. In the same week I visited Galbot with Chen Lang, I made my way to the outskirts of Beijing to what the city government claims is China's largest robot training center. It is affiliated with Leju Robotics, a company whose robots do not learn from simulations, but real examples provided by human data collectors, or teleoperators. The company's flagship humanoid, Quavo, has already been deployed in some electric vehicle factories around China, performing basic tasks such as unstacking cardboard boxes. In the Beijing Training Center, roughly 100 teleoperators were arranged in neat rows in a sectioned-off corner of a warehouse. Each workstation had two people to every robot, doing a different task, such as wiping down a table, organizing cutlery, or moving a glass of water. On the second floor, teleoperators trained robots on industrial use cases, such as sorting and packing boxes. I watched as one worker in a VR-like headset maneuvered his robot's hand around a potato, lifting it slowly from a table and lowering it into a basket. Then the robot reached for a blue cloth to wipe down the table. Another worker sat behind a laptop where he logged each action, say, whether it was successful or not, into the database. At another workstation, one worker guided his robot to pour water into a bowl. It missed. The water spilled and began running over the edge. Its human partner stood up from the desk and cleaned up the mess. Then they did the action sequence again. There were roughly equal numbers of men and women among the teleoperators. Most looked like they were in their late teens or early 20s. They told me that typically do 15 different tasks a day with the robots, 10 times each on 8-hour shifts. Chinese officials had framed teleoperations as a new vocational training program. But there are already reports of how dehumanizing the work can be. One former employee who worked in a robot training lab in Tesla's Palo Alto headquarters told a Business Insider reporter that it was like being a lab rat under a microscope. A day after my visit to Leju, Victor Wang, co-founder of Cybot, a startup that specializes in making robotic hands and has been in talks with the fast fashion retailer Shine to replace workers performing the most basic task on the garment line, invited me to try out the teleoperation sequence at his Beijing offices. The task was to pick up clothes from a pile and drop them into a bin. I put on skeletal gloves with Velcro straps, linked electronically to a humanoid's hands positioned beside me. The connection between my hand and the machine was not as smooth as I was expecting. It felt clunky, like operating the claw machine in an arcade. It took me several tries to get the machine to do the required motion. Teleoperating, I realized, is not simply a matter of performing human actions that the robot learns. When you're doing a sequence, you must move at a speed that the machine can register. You must keep your arms in a set position throughout. You cannot do normal human things such as scratch an itch. Doing so would pollute the data. The process was more physically taxing and stranger than I expected. We are training our robots to be more like humans. Doing so requires that humans act more like robots. I took a high-speed train to Hefei to see a newly built Huawei car factory where several of Chen Ling's robots, including the wheel window dashboard installation machines, have been deployed. Once a rural backwater, Hefei has transformed into an industrial center that, together with its surrounding areas, produces more cars than Michigan. I took a cab to an enormous factory complex on the southern outskirts, where Huawei churns out its newest electric ultra-luxury sedan, the Maxtro S800. Trent greeted me in the factory cafeteria with his familiar grin. Before we stepped onto the factory floor, his engineers helped me into some steel-toed shoes. We started our tour at the flow racks, where workers pick up component parts, sensors, wires, etc., and place them into bins. These kind of repetitive pick-and-place tasks are seen as particularly ripe for automation. Even here, Chen told me, humanoid robots do not yet match up to their human counterparts. Deeper into the factory, we could see a line of car bodies moving along an assembly line. Workers lined both sides, jumping in and out of the car shell with drills and other tools, tightening bolts and snapping connectors into place. I got a sense of just how hard it would be to automate this. When the Maxtro sedan reached Chen's workstation, the car was hoisted onto a raised platform where three robotic arms sprang into action. One arm locked a dashboard into place. The other two bolted them onto the car in seconds. The Gucci engineers stood behind a monitor. They were there mostly for troubleshooting. Before, workers had to guide robotic arms manually, and each car model needed different kinds of tooling because the models varied so widely, said Chen. No longer. Chin is clear-eyed about deep learning's limitations. He believes much of the assembly work in the factory will be close to fully automated by the mid-2030s. We reached a station where 5 to 6 workers huddled under the raised Huawei car, craning their necks to bolt screws and tightening connectors by hand. Long term, this causes spinal damage, Chin told me matter-of-factly. It was better that they be replaced by humanoids. There are 120 million workers in Chinese factories today, several million of whom, like the workers in front of me, had undertaken 3 to 5 years of vocational training. I asked Chin what this meant for their successors, those in middle school hoping to undergo training in advanced manufacturing now. They definitely need to change careers, he said. A couple of weeks earlier, back at the warehouse at Gucci's Shanghai headquarters, Chin and I had watched the General Motors employees prepare to ship Chin's machines to the West. Chin would shortly be traveling to the U.S., where he was planning to visit Tesla and General Motors to seek new business opportunities. Under successive administrations, we have heard that the U.S. is committed to decoupling from China. But the reality is more complicated. It is not just American businesses that need China. The reverse is also true. Working with Americans is no longer optional. It's inevitable, Chin told me. And besides, he added, Americans pay on time. This was adapted from a story originally published in The Guardian. And I think we can get one of the Talking Points articles. Artemis II, bringing awe to Earth. When the crew of Artemis II splashed down off the coast of San Diego last week, it felt as though the entire world was watching, said the Free Press in an editorial. Crowds gathered on California beaches, children on the East Coast stayed up late for the broadcast, and millions of people across the planet waited for the safe return of the 4 astronauts who had ventured further into space than any human before them, some 252,756 miles from the Earth. The 10-day NASA mission captured the public's imagination in a way that no expedition has done in decades, perhaps because this was the first time since 1972 that humans had traveled around the moon. Or maybe it was the stunning images that the crew took of the moon's far side, with a blue-green Earth rising above the gray, pockmarked lunar surface. Or perhaps it was the very human moments we saw inside the 300-square-foot capsule, like when the crew embraced in a tearful group hug after naming a crater for Commander Reed Weissman's late wife, Carol. These were not robots sent into the unknown. They were us. The mission was a reminder of the sheer vastness of outer space, said Ruth Graham in the New York Times. Many of us here on Earth became children at camp, lying supine and looking up at the stars, thinking very big thoughts. And this was just a test flight for the other giant leaps. The Artemis program aims to put astronauts back on the lunar surface by 2028. The science that makes such feats possible is spectacular, said Lisa Jarvis in Bloomberg. Yet the ability to do this kind of work has never felt so tenuous. The Trump administration last year slashed funding for federal scientific agencies, including NASA. And Trump's latest budget proposal, released 2 days after Artemis II blasted off, would shrink the space agency's funding by another 23%, or $5.6 billion. If that cut goes ahead, the U.S. won't be at the center of the next awe-inspiring event. Let's hope that never happens, because NASA has just shown us what truly makes America great, said Rick Wilson in his Substack newsletter. Not arrogance, not bluster. It's scientists, astronauts, and engineers spending years accumulating expertise and deploying it toward a goal that matters. Amid the chaos and dysfunction of the Trump administration, Artemis II reminded us that there is still an America that knows how to do hard things, that plans ahead, that checks its work. It's competency porn, and God, we are starving for it, dying for it. And one or two of the short notes. The U.S. fertility rate hit a record low in 2025, dropping to 53.1 births per 1,000 women of childbearing age, a 1% decrease since 2024. The decline is in part a result of a sharp drop in teenage births. There were 11.7 births per 1,000 females ages 15 to 19 last year, down 7% from 2024. On the poll watch, 46% of Americans believe the facts on vaccines are up for debate and that it's damaging to mandate shots. 39% say the science is clear and that it's dangerous to question it. And we'll finish with a quote from Frederick Douglass. Liberty is meaningless where the right to utter one's thoughts and opinions has ceased to exist. With that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. Hope you've enjoyed it. Please join us again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. The Week magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. And as always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.